for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Washington Post publisher Catherine Weymouth is the latest in a succession of family members who've held that position. But she's also chief executive officer of Washington Post Media, a title that reflects how much the paper has changed since her great-grandfather bought it during the Depression and her grandmother led it through the Watergate scandal. Catherine Weymouth joins me in the studio to talk about carrying on her family's journalistic legacy at a time of 24-hour news cycles and online information sites. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Catherine, it's good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Talk about that title, Chief Executive Officer of Washington Post Media. What does it encompass?
We really were just trying to recognize what we have become, which is really a news organization disseminating on multiple platforms. So it recognizes everything from the free daily tab we have, Express, locally here, as well as WashingtonPost.com, as well as El Tiempo Latino, which is the leading weekly Hispanic in the area, and, of course, the Washington Post newspaper.
Now, you come here, pardon me, at a time when there's a deal on to sell Newsweek. Now, first of all, why is the Washington Post selling Newsweek?
I should say Newsweek is actually not under my supervision, so I wasn't involved in the decision to sell it. That really was Don Graham, my uncle, and the chairman of the company and the CEO of the company, working with the folks running Newsweek, Ann McDaniel and Tom Aschheim. So I know it was a heart-wrenching decision and a difficult one, but one that they felt made sense under the current challenges that Newsweeklies particularly face. We're all facing challenges, but I think
sure.
The Newsweekly magazine really faced them.
Are you talking about financial challenges, circulation challenges?
Yes, excuse me, really financial challenges. Newsweek has been losing money, as have we at the Washington Post. And I think, as was said in the public statement, they just couldn't figure out a future for Newsweek and are really hoping that somebody will come forward or a company will come forward to buy it and preserve what we all love about Newsweek and what we hope to see continue.
But as may have said, if the Washington Post can't figure it out, who could?
Well, I think we'd love to feel that way. But I think it's a great brand with incredible talent. And if you had somebody out there with enough pockets to take a hit, at least for a little while it turned around, I think we believe that there is a future for Newsweek. We just didn't think it made sense for us.
Catherine, what is the division of labor? Do you get involved in the editorial side?
Well, as publisher, the editorial side reports to me, as does the business side. So I don't interfere. I hire Marcus Broccoli, our executive editor, and so I'm a big believer in hiring the best talent you can find and letting them do what they do well. So I don't get involved unless they were to come to me and say, here's a challenge we face, what do you think? Or some other reason arose that I had to get involved.
How often does that happen?
Not very often. I think we have throughout the company a good rule, which is the no surprises rule. So if we're about to publish a story that's big or that involves the government or, secrets or whatever, Marcus would certainly call me to say, look, Catherine, this is going on. If we need you to get involved to make a final decision, we will. But most of the time he makes the decisions working with the newsroom and our attorneys.
Is that comfortable for you, that is, staying out of the editorial side, for the most part, considering the fact that certainly your grandmother, mm-hmm. certainly your uncle were very, and your grandfather as well, were certainly very involved in the editorial process?
You know, I don't think I've taken a different approach. I mean, maybe in the era of Phil Graham, he actually wrote stories and Eugene Meyer wrote. But my grandmother and my uncle firmly believed in hiring great editors and then letting them do their thing. I think grandma got involved, you know, when Watergate was happening because it was a big deal. It could have brought the paper down, obviously.
Yeah.
And she had to be on board. They had to have her support. But really, it was, you know, she trusted Ben. She hired Ben to run the newsroom, and she knew
Ben
he did
Bradley.
A great job. Excuse me, Ben Bradley, yes. And so I feel the same way about Marcus. So I feel like I have an incredible newsroom full of talented editors and journalists, and the best thing I can do is let them run, let them do their journalism.
Catherine Weymouth, she's chief executive officer of Washington Post Media and publisher of The Washington Post. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Of course, when your grandmother, whom I adored, was alive, she was on this program. And to hear you call her grandma puts it really down to earth. How close were you to her?
Well, I should say she was a big fan of yours, too. And I actually remember meeting you for the first time with her. I was very close to her, and I certainly, I'm named after her, and I was the oldest grandchild. So we spent a fair amount of time together, particularly when I moved to Washington shortly after I graduated from law school. And we were both single, and so we often would spend Friday evenings together, and we would sit in front in her library watching the Jim Lehrer show and chit-chatting over TV dinners.
So you had quite a close relationship.
Yeah, it was really nice. And I would just tell her what was going on in my life, at work and personally, and she would laugh. And she would tell me what was going on in her life. And it was a time in her life when she was doing less. She was writing her book, and she was more relaxed. And so she had that kind of time.
But did you envision yourself in the place you are now as you were growing up?
Never.
Never.
And in fact, in my high school yearbook, I got voted most likely to become publisher of the New York Post. So, no, I always wanted to be a lawyer and ultimately a prosecutor. And I think because I grew up in New York, we were aware of what my grandmother's job was and later my uncle's, and proud of her. But it didn't really occur to me that I would end up at the Washington Post.
You studied ballet.
I did.
To a great extent.
I did.
Did you have an ambition there?
I did. I was lucky. I was at the School of American Ballet in New York, which was the Balanchine School and fed into the New York City Ballet. It's a very serious school. I was passionate about it. But I came to a point when I realized I wasn't good enough to be a star. And my mother was great about sort of, look, you have a choice to make. If you pursue this, you're not going to get an education, and what's your life going to be? And so I made a really hard decision to leave ballet and, you know, go and pursue, go to college.
And practice law.
And practice law.
So what happened to that desire to practice law to become a prosecutor?
You know, it just evolved. I moved to Washington. I worked at Williams & Connolly in town after clerking for a judge for a year. And I loved it. It was a great, I sort of view it as my Marine Corps experience. It was hard, but I learned a tremendous amount. I worked with amazing people. And my uncle began to talk to me about coming to the Post as a lawyer with the skill that I knew. And I began to think about it, and I knew it was an amazing privilege and opportunity. I just was concerned about what it would be like to go into a family business and whether I would be welcomed or disliked and whether I would be good at it and what if I wasn't. So the first time he asked me to join, I turned it down. Hmm. And then later, after I had just finished a trial with a partner, one of the partners at the law firm sent around an email to the associates saying, We've agreed to lend the Washington Post an attorney for 3 months. They're short-staffed. Is anybody interested? It will not be held against you for partner track. And I called the partner up because I thought it was what a perfect way to dip my toe in without making a commitment way or the other.
Three months.
And I called the partner up and said, what about me? And he laughed. And so I went and—
Doing what?
In the legal department, doing sort of general work, everything from reviewing contracts and employment disputes to— Once in a blue moon, looking at a story in the newsroom, And obviously, I loved it and
did you
found that it was
right
great,
away?
And I stayed. Yeah, I mean, it was a big change from being in a law firm, but I think, you know, it's an incredible privilege to be at the paper and to see what goes into putting it out. And then it really was a paper and nothing else. There were wonderful people, and I found that they were actually, at least to my face, very welcoming of having another family member there.
When you say to your face, do you think there was some resentment?
I never felt it, but, you know, I never know, and I'm not sure if people would tell me, but it would be understandable if there were, but I haven't heard it or felt it.
But it felt quite comfortable for you.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
And so at the end of the 3 months,
I decided to stay, and I stayed in the legal department, and I stayed there for 2 years at the paper, and then I went over to WashingtonPost.com and was in the legal department there for 2 years before coming back to the paper in the advertising department.
And after the advertising department and your 4 years in legal matters, did you feel ready to move to the position you now hold?
No, and I don't think I thought about it that way. I'm somebody who sort of is in the present, and I was asked by the vice president of advertising at the time to come join the advertising department as a liaison between print and online, and I thought that was an exciting opportunity.
Catherine Weymouth, she's chief executive officer of Washington Post Media, publisher of The Washington Post. I hope you'll join us. Questions, comments, stay with us. And welcome back. Catherine Weymouth is with me. She is, of course, the granddaughter of Catherine Graham. She is now chief executive officer of Washington Post Media. She's publisher of the Washington Post. And she is a very young, formidable woman. She has 3 young children. She is a single mother carrying a massive burden that way, but also the Washington Post on her shoulders. Catherine, there are an awful lot of people who feel the Post has changed, that it has shrunk in terms of its size, shrunk in terms of its editorial content, shrunk in terms of its relevance to what's happening nationally and internationally. How do you respond?
You know, I think the Post has changed and needs to change. You know, we have to continue to evolve. And I think editorially, the Washington Post in print, on the web, et cetera, is as good, if not better, than it has ever been. I think the coverage is absolutely first rate. As you know, we won 4 Pulitzer Prizes this year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And, you know, that's not the only standard of journalism, but it is one recognition of terrific work by our newsroom. But it has changed. And one of the wonderful things about the Post, particularly the paper, is people have a relationship with it and they care about it and they don't like it often when you change things. So we try not to take away things that people love, but we've made some decisions either for business reasons or editorial reasons or that some readers have chafed at. And we've also introduced new things. We just introduced a new local business publication on Mondays. We have a whole new local website. We have a new local politics page. We have a mobile site. We're developing an iPad app. And, you know, so we're developing a lot of new wonderful content, including Gene Weingarten's new comic strip this Monday. And we've taken some things away, like Stock Agate, that many newspapers took away a long time ago. It's a hard decision. For some people, that's a difficult decision, and we regret it, but it was just a decision that made sense.
What one decision would you say has brought the greatest number of complaints?
It was when we removed a comic strip, the Judge Parker comic strip.
Oh, boy, I remember that.
Yes. And, you know, we had done research. It was consistently one of the bottom performers in all the research, and we had decided we needed extra space, so we decided to take away two comic strips. And I got more email and calls, and the editorial, the newsroom did too. And finally, Marcus and I talked. We was like, can you please put it back?
Yes, exactly.
I still get people thanking me for putting it back.
Really?
So, but, you know, it's great. In a way, we're so lucky that people care that much.
How about the Washington Post magazine? How is that doing these days?
I think it's doing okay. I think we're still trying to find its identity. And, you know, it's a wonderful magazine. It has fantastic features that we've introduced. But it, too, is evolving. And we're trying to sort of find its voice and its niche and what readers want for it. Because it's, you know, it's mostly a local magazine and we cover all kinds of different subjects.
You've had some, how shall we put it, controversial decisions that you've made and had to back out of. The decision, for example, to hold salons. Talk about what went into that decision, what the reaction was, and how you dealt with it.
That we had decided that as we looked at our strategy, which is really to be the news entity for and about Washington, that part of that ought to be live, that we ought to have a conferences business, as many other media organizations do. And part of that conferences strategy, I thought it was a good idea to do dinners as well and have them be sponsored. And we had a marketing flyer that went out that implied in some way that we were selling access, which is something we would never do. So it was a big firestorm, as I'm sure you recall, and I learned my lesson the hard way. And it was something I would take back if I could. We didn't do it, or we shouldn't have done it, excuse me. We didn't hold any dinners. But I also said to my team, I said, look, first and foremost, I'm sorry I let down the paper and our readers and you internally, but I said, we need to learn from this. I'm going to make mistakes. I'm going to make more mistakes, and I will own it. I will accept responsibility from it. But I said, the worst thing that can come out of this is that we are so afraid we don't do anything. We need to take risks, and we need to try new things, and not any risk that is going to impugn our integrity. And that was the mistake I made in this case. But, for example, we do have a live division, and we just held our first event in the last month, and it was a great success. So I think we're going to stay away from dinners, but we are going to do live events, and they're great news events, and they're you know, they ought to be a decent business, too.
Describe that live event you had.
It was a lunch for local business leaders in the area, and we focused on the economy of the Beltway, and it was by invitation, and people paid money to come, and we had sponsors, and it was really a terrific on-the-record event, which is the difference. From now on, they will all be on-the-record events.
And reporters were present to be asked questions, to engage with business leaders.
Correct.
Now, when you talk about the Washington Post as a Washington newspaper, is that the direction that you, Catherine Weymouth, want to take the Post as opposed to the national and international newspaper it had been under your grandmother and grandfather?
I think we view it as really not a change from what it has been. We are a unique newspaper. We always have been because we are in Washington, which, of course, is the nation's capital. So we have always worked very hard. We have a large metro staff to cover Washington as a local community. We have readers who live in Fairfax, and we now, thanks to the internet, have readers who live all over the country and internationally. And because we're in the nation's capital, a Washington story is what's happening at the White House as well as what's happening in Afghanistan. So we don't in any way intend to change our coverage of events of national significance, whether it's the BP oil spill or the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it really isn't a change except to really focus on what our readers expect from us.
But what about shutting down foreign news bureaus?
We've shut down one or two, but really we shut down some of our national bureaus, but not as a decision to not cover national affairs. I think our view was just because you have a reporter sitting in L.A., you know, when the BP oil spill happens, we might not have somebody in Shreveport, but we're going to send somebody to Shreveport. When the hurricane happens, we're going to send people there. If there's a story in Chicago, we'll send people there. So it really was more of a reorganization of the way we cover things. It was not in any way a decision to cut back on what we cover.
How much staff has been cut in the past 3 or 4 years?
We have cut probably, you know, well over 100 reporters and editors. And it was something that was hard to do, but we needed to do. And we've worked really hard to make sure that, if anything, our coverage is getting better. It requires us to just do things differently. And it's hard to see great people go, but we've also hired terrific new talent that we're really excited about. And Marcus also reorganized the newsroom in a way that it really reflects the world around us. It is now organized by topic as opposed to by newspaper section, and that really made a lot of sense. Hmm.
So how would you describe the financial health of the Washington Post now?
Well, it's improving, and we're working hard to get it back to profitability as fast as we can, because we need to do that both for ourselves as a business. You know, my grandmother would often say, in order to do good, you must do well. And we firmly believe that we have to be a healthy business in order to invest in the journalism that we all care about. So our first quarter results just came out, and we had a $40 million improvement over this time last year, which, of course, was the biggest economic downturn we've seen since the Great Depression. So we're not totally out of the woods, but we are well on our way.
Who or what would you regard as your greatest competition?
Well, that is a great question, because we face it in every niche and on every front. Mm-hmm. And it's for a little while, one of the positions I held was running the Help Wanted section. Mm. And so if you just take that as an example, you have Monster, you have Career Builder, you name it. On the news front, we have everything from Google, Yahoo, you know, the aggregators, to Politico, you know. So it's competition on every front, and I don't think that's bad for us. I think we had a wonderful niche for a little while as one of the big games in town without a lot of competition, and you can get a little bit complacent when that happens. So I think now we're just all really focused in every niche on making sure that we are the best that we can be.
So do want ads bring in the greatest source of revenue?
Well, they used to.
You
know, the world has changed a lot, right? In the, you know, for a while, if you were looking for a job, you looked in the Washington Post pages. And today, you still do, but you will also likely look online. And WashingtonPost.com jobs is actually the number one job site in the area. But you may also look at Monster, CareerBuilder, et cetera.
So, and all of that is less expensive?
It's all much less expensive, yes. So the margins aren't there the way they used to be.
Catherine, tell me about how you manage 3 children as a single mother and the Washington Post.
By the seat of my pants,
yeah,
is probably
I'll
the honest
I'll
answer.
Bet.
And, you know, I'm really lucky I'm able to have help, and I don't think I could do what I do without help. And it's a great gift. You know, it's, I took my kids to school this morning like I try to do every morning. And this afternoon, my kindergartner has her end of year class party, and I will be there if I can, which I intend to be. So you just juggle and you try to be there for the moments that are important for the kids, as well as for just regular downtime. Like on their birthdays, I always let them pick out one cupcake. I have a cupcake book, and they get to pick out their favorite one, and I bake it for them and bring it into school. And then, you know, at work, thank God for Blackberries, because it means you can be at home and making sure you're up to date, and, you know, communication and technology makes it all a little bit easier.
What's the hardest part for you?
I think the hardest part is feeling like you're never giving as much as you want to give in any one arena.
Either for the children or for your workplace?
Yes. I mean, so, you know, my 6-year-old recently said to me, "Mommy, why can't you just quit and, you know, be at home like the other moms?" And I said, "Well, because, you know, among other things, I like to work, but also we need to pay the bills." And she said, "Well, just go to the bank." And I said, "Well, that's how the money gets in the bank." So, you know.
It's a good lesson.
Yes.
Catherine Weymouth is with me, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones. 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Dearborn, Michigan. Good morning, Joe. You're on the air.
Yes, I was a longtime subscriber to the Washington Post National Weekly, and it just stopped coming. I called the toll-free number, which seems to have been disconnected. Did it go out of business?
Yes, I'm sorry to say that we did make a decision to close down the National Weekly.
Why?
It wasn't profitable, and the readership was declining in an era when people can get news in so many different sources. It didn't really make sense to send out a weekly print publication across the nation anymore, but we were sorry for the readers who enjoyed it.
Here's an email from Keith in Cleveland. He says it's very easy to understand the decline of the Washington Post. They hire people like Mark Thiessen to their op-ed page. He has no qualifications other than being a speechwriter for President Bush. Yet he's presented by the Post as some kind of expert on torture policy when he actually has a vested interest in defending these criminal policies.
You know, Fred Hyatt is our editorial page editor, and he has worked hard to bring all kinds of different voices to the editorial page, both in the paper and online. And we have found that people love opinion on the web, and so we do a lot of both side issues and present voices of different sides.
Here's an email from Columbia, Missouri. Craig says, "My understanding is that smaller community papers did not experience the circulation drop-off that large dailies suffered. Newspapers, large and small, took a hit in ad revenues during the economic downturn, but people continue to value their local newspapers as the only authoritative source of local news. Newspapers are not as lucrative as they once were. But does your guest think predictions of the demise of newspapers may be a bit premature?"
I do think they're premature. I think what we know from our users and readers is that there is a greater demand for quality news than there ever was at a time when people are flooded with information from everywhere. You know, we had over roughly 10 million unique visitors on WashingtonPost.com in the last month. We still have over 500,000 subscribers to the daily paper, which is over 1 million readers a day and over 2 million on Sunday. So that is one reason why we are committed to covering Washington as a community. We know that local news is really important to people.
As you see the .com going up, do you see circulation going down?
You know, I don't see them as correlated like that. I think we know that people come to the newspaper and have come to the newspaper for all kinds of different reasons, whether it was the weather or horoscope or a comic strip. And so now people have multiple sources for all kinds of things, whether they're going to buy a car, get a job, et cetera. So I think people are engaged and they're just getting their news everywhere now, including on the web.
But what about the fact that by the time the Morning Post comes out, the news has already changed online?
Yeah, and I mean, that's one reason why in the paper we try to do more, not just telling you what happened yesterday, but why does it matter, more kind of analysis. Because, of course, people can get breaking news and headlines, including on WashingtonPost.com, 24/7. But many people still rely on the paper as their primary source of news.
Well, I certainly do. Catherine Weymouth, she's Chief Executive Officer of Washington Post Media, publisher of The Washington Post. When we come back, more of your calls, your email. We'll take your messages from Facebook and Twitter.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
When Gary Rivlin set out to write his new book, Broke USA, about payday lenders and the check cashing industry, he wanted to know how the businesses justified making huge profits off the working poor.
They tend to cast themselves as noble. You know, we're in neighborhoods doing business where others don't go. It's almost heroic.
Gary Rivlin joins us on the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back to my conversation with Catherine Weymouth. She is a young woman in a very, very high-level position. She is Chief Executive Officer of Washington Post Media, publisher of The Washington Post. Here's an email from Boston, Massachusetts. Greg says, "Do you have interaction with Warren Buffett, who had been a longtime board member, friend of the paper, strong advocate of the paper's work on Watergate, and certainly friend of Katharine Graham. What is Mr. Buffett's relationship with the paper like these days as the business evolves and adapts to the changes in print digital media?"
Well, I'm privileged, thanks to my grandmother's friendship with him, to have known him since I was a child. But currently he is our lead director on the board of directors, and so I see him when he comes for board meetings, and I present in front of him, and he asks, not surprisingly, terrific questions. So I would say he's a supportive but serious director.
That's terrific that he remains involved. Here's a question from Arlington, Virginia. How can the Post compete with the Washington Examiner, a free daily tabloid owned by low-profile Denver-based billionaire Philip Anschutz.
Well, I can't really comment on The Examiner. I think we just try to focus on doing the best we can for our readers and publishing great journalism every single day, and I think we do a good job of that.
He goes on to say, is this the future of print media, losing large amounts of money in order to influence public opinion? Perhaps Mr. Anschutz sees this as simply the cost of doing business.
Well, I think we all know that the business model behind news organizations is a challenged one. But it's funny, I went back and looked at my grandmother's book in the beginning, and she writes about when her grandfather bought the paper at a bankruptcy auction in 1933. And then she writes, in 1942, she describes him as happy as a little boy because for the first time, the Post was going to break even. So, you know, the window we had where we had terrific margins was actually a relatively small window. And I think it's true of newspapers generally. So our business model is changing, and we will not be losing. We will get back to profitability. But we want to do that with the mission of supporting the journalism we all care about.
All right. To Gainesville, Florida. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, Ms. Weymouth. And a privilege to be on the air with both of you. I first want to comment real quickly. Somebody made a comment on commentary a few minutes ago. Actually, I think his name was Keith also. And, you know, an op-ed that evokes a strong reaction, to me an op-ed is sort of like a work of art. If it evokes a strong reaction, it has served its purpose. And that you will continue to print op-eds that evoke a reaction is part of what makes you an actual newspaper and not a tabloid. On that, a related line, a number of years ago when I worked on some investigations with the space program, this is going back to Challenger and to Tropic Magazine out of the Miami Herald, which I think you have some folks from there with you now. There were NASA and other agencies were routinely revoking press passes when people were not reporting what they wanted reported. And I have heard that still goes on in indirect ways today. I'm sure you don't approve of it. Have you heard of it going on? And would you take a firm stance if you knew confidently that a person's press pass status was being threatened? Would you just say, fine, we're just going to stand on the sidewalk and report?
No, I think, of course, we wouldn't. And we work with lawyers all the time when we have trouble getting access to information that we think is important to our readers. So we absolutely view that as part of our job, is to expose and make public, you know, the goings-on of government and agencies, et cetera.
What kind of relationship does the Washington Post have with the current administration?
I think it's the same as any other major news organization. We cover them. We have a team of White House reporters who travel with the administration and members of the administration and try to develop relationships with them so that we can get access for information, but also make sure that we challenge information when we think it needs to be challenged.
Do you think of the Post as being adversarial to the White House?
No, not at all. I think, you know, we have the principles that my great-grandfather articulated when he bought the Post in the building, and one of them is that the first mission is to tell the truth as nearly as the truth may be ascertained. So we're not perfect. We don't always get it right, but that is the mission.
Here's an email from Howard in Washington, D.C. He says, as a subscriber to the Post for over 20 years, I'm disappointed by continuing cuts in physical size and content of the newspaper, as well as more filler, including gossip, splashy graphic designs, drawings of personalities who used to be reporters. It just seems like a downward spiral. At some point, it just won't be worth it to subscribe. But I hope it doesn't get to that point. Why should I be optimistic?
You know, as I said, I may be biased, but we have a lot of readers backing up my feeling that the Post is as good, if not better, than it's ever been. We are evolving. We are changing with the times, but in ways that we feel are good. And I think, you know, when you look at the stories that we're doing every day, you look at Paul Duggan's story last week on the shootings in Southeast, you just can't find that kind of journalism in very many other organizations, the kind of original content we generate, the op-ed pages we have, the editorials we write. I think we, and, you know, it costs 75 cents to get the daily paper and $2 on Sunday. I don't think there's much else of that kind of value you can buy for that price.
You were actually criticized last year for allegedly saying you wanted happier stories in the paper. Did you say that, and what was the reaction you got?
I didn't say that, and I wouldn't say that. As I said, I try not to interfere on the editorial side. I had made some off-the-cuff remarks internally, as well as to a friend, about some of the stories in the magazine. I felt that the magazine was not the best that it could be for a local city magazine.
So
I simply made some off-the-cuff remarks. That was the end of it. And Marcus, separately, working with Raju Narasetty and Liz Spade, his deputy editors, put a new editor in charge of the magazine, but not because I told them to, because they thought they wanted the magazine to reflect their own vision of what the magazine should be.
Do you think it's improved?
I think it is improved. I think we have fantastic features in the magazine, and it's, as I said earlier, it's working to find its voice for Washington.
All right. To Jane in Germantown, Maryland. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm so privileged to speak with both of you. And Catherine, I applaud all of the roles that you're playing as a young mother and as the CEO of a major corporation. I would like to know, when you're alone in a place of peace, what gives you delight? Thank you.
That's a nice question. A lot of things. I mean, my kids first and foremost, of course. But I also love to read and cook and exercise when I can.
Do you like to entertain?
I do. I mean, just cooking, just for my friends. Nothing formal.
So you don't see yourself in perhaps the same role your grandmother had in terms of all of social Washington coming to your home?
No, I don't entertain like that. I just entertain my friends, and interesting people
exactly.
that I meet.
Exactly. All right. I hope that answers it, Jane. Let's go now to Stowe, Ohio. Good morning, Nellie. You're on the air.
Good morning. Since trillions of trees are the main cause of the environmental devastation around the world, that is aside from the BP oil spill, what is the Post doing to increase recycled or cotton fibers? And secondly, is not the Post muzzling the voice of three-quarters of the country which opposes the war in Afghanistan?
Let me address the recycling question first. We actually do everything we can to help the environment, including we use paper with the highest amount of recycled fiber that you can get. We recycle the plates we use. So we're doing everything. And we also use pulp trees, which actually have to be cut down within 12 years anyway. So we are still on a printed product because we feel our readers want to get it that way. But we're trying to help the environment in every way we can.
She also asked about Afghanistan.
Yeah, I don't think we're trying to muzzle anything. And in fact, if you look at the coverage that Greg Jaffe has been doing from Afghanistan and Rajiv Chandrasekharan, I think our coverage has been first rate and continues to be.
All right. To Indianapolis. Good morning, Ray.
Oh, good morning. I'm just calling to say congratulations on Tom Tolles as the lead editorial cartoonist. I've been enjoying his work since he was with the Buffalo Evening News 30 years ago. He's absolutely fantastic, always on point, whether he's skewering a Republican or a Democrat. And I think it's fantastic that he's with the Post now.
Thank you. That's great to hear. We
think sure
it's fantastic,
too. I'm sure he'll be happy to hear that, too. All right, to Rockville, Maryland. Good morning, Roseanne. Roseanne, are you there? Okay. To Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, ladies. It's a pleasure to be on the air with you.
Thank you.
Catherine, I'd like to say, first of all, I've always enjoyed the Washington Post. I used to read it every day when I lived there. Unfortunately, I now live in South Florida and cannot get my hands on a hard copy, at least not within the same week. Have you considered using a business model similar to the New York Times, whereby apparently they've partnered with stores or outlets like 7-Eleven and some of the other stores, so that on a daily basis you can get a hard copy of the Washington Post, even here in Florida?
We have considered that, but the New York Times is a very different business model. And for us, it simply doesn't make sense to distribute a printed copy outside of the Washington area. But I can tell you that my father and stepmother live in Tampa, Florida, and read the Post every day on WashingtonPost.com.
So that's what you'd recommend.
That is
at this point. You have no plans to expand that print publication to other areas?
No, it doesn't make sense for us. And also, we feel like, thanks to all this amazing technology, you really can read the Washington Post on anything from your iPad to your phone to WashingtonPost.com.
But how long do you think that's going to last, Catherine? That is that desire to hold a newspaper as opposed to the younger generation simply reading online.
You know, I don't have the answer any more than anyone else does. I can say for me, I can't imagine not having the printed paper because I just think it's a wonderful, very satisfying experience, and many of our readers do too. But we all know that the younger generation consumes news and information in different ways, and that's okay. So we will continue to publish news on any platform our consumers want to get it on.
Catherine Weymouth, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Columbia, Missouri. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Good, thanks.
Oh, good, good. I just was going to comment. My grandfather, when I would go to his house, there'd be really no telling who would be there. But your grandmother, Catherine Graham, would be there every now and then. And it was just a wonderful evening. You know, here was the grand dame of society of Washington, D.C., just about. And she was just really down to home and told great stories. And it really brightened up my childhood when she was there. And I guess that's all I had to say.
Tell me who your grandfather was, Rick.
His name was Bernard Duran. He was in the CIA. He was like in charge of the internal security division of the CIA.
I see. Thanks for calling. Does that name ring a bell to you?
It doesn't, but I will tell you just a quick story. Right before I was named publisher, one of my colleagues at work had come into my office and she said, "Catherine, I don't know if you've noticed it, but sometimes the elevator just stops on the lobby floor when you haven't pressed it and nobody gets on or off." And she said, "The girls I work with think that's your grandmother getting on." And the day that I was named publisher, I was very nervous. And I came up and the elevator stopped on the lobby floor, even though I had not pushed the button and nobody got on or off. And I thought, maybe that's grandma giving me a little support.
Oh, I love that. Do you feel her presence there at the Post?
Well, I like to think I do. And through her son, Don, and my mother, Lally, that I have her influence that way, too.
And your mother is writing for Newsweek. So what's going to happen to her if Newsweek is sold?
I think we're still working through what will happen with Newsweek, but I think if and when Newsweek is sold, my mother, if she's willing, will come work for the Post and do the same kinds of fantastic foreign journalism she does now for Newsweek.
What's your greatest ambition for the Post as you sit here now?
To make sure that we continue to be an absolute first-rate newspaper in the nation's capital and serve the needs of our readers.
But what about the world?
By readers, I mean of the world, you know, I think it's...
And
for the world, yes.
Because at this point, it would seem that coverage is shrinking. But you don't see that.
I don't see that. I mean, I think we have had to make tough decisions, but as I have said in some other forums, when you look at the staff we had during Watergate, it was less than half of what it is today.
Really?
Yes. And so I'm not saying I want to get back there. We
right.
don't. We want to invest in our newsroom. But I think we can continue to put out, as we have in the past, fantastic journalism with slightly smaller numbers.
But what you're saying, too, is that after Watergate, the newspaper grew and grew and grew.
Well, I think when we have profits, that's where we want to put them. That is our engine. That's what we all care about. It's the news that we're passionate about. And so that's where we invest our money. And that's why we need to remain profitable.
Catherine Weymouth, she's Chief Executive Officer of Washington Post Media, publisher of The Washington Post, a young woman with a great responsibility on her shoulders. I'm glad you were here, Catherine.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.